open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I know so much about mosquitoes and malaria, I could keep you here all night.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Many writers struggle to start a new book, but Ann Patchett says she can always tell when it's time to get started.
And you begin to write at the moment when the idea of writing becomes less painful than the idea of not writing. And I always say it's like breaking into Fort Knox with an emery board. I have this whole book in my mind. How do I get in? How do I get in? How do I get in? And then finally I get in.
Ann Patchett is the author of such novels as Bel Canto, State of Wonder, and The Patron Saint of Liars. Her new novel, Commonwealth, draws heavily on the experiences of her life. The narrative shifts back and forth from past to present and from California to Virginia, the Commonwealth of the title. Patchett talks this hour with actor and writer Benjamin Bush. He questions Patchett why her books haven't been made into movies.
The reason that this isn't a movie, one, it's only been out 6 weeks and somebody would have to be really fast. Two, it covers 52 years, so it would have to be an HBO series. And three, it is a book about an autobiographical novel about a family that is made into a movie that destroys the family. And when I turned it in, I was talking to my agent, and he said, may I give this to the film department at ICM? And I said, let me think about it for a minute. And he said, okay, I'll call you back, we'll talk later. And I said, no, literally, a minute. Let me just, give me 1 minute on the phone. No. I mean, what
do you... That was less than a minute.
What do you have? Well, we're speeding it up because we're in front of an audience.
5 decades, I understand.
Yeah, I don't think that there would be anything to be gained by it. I have an incredibly happy life, and I love my job, and I'm a cheerful person. And the only thing in my work that has consistently gotten me down is my interface with the film industry. And I just don't do it anymore.
Me too.
People keep saying to me on this tour, oh, I heard Bel Canto is going to be a movie, and I just keep saying it's gossip. At this point, all three of the female leads from The Hours have been cast as Roxanne Coss. I'm not joking. Nicole Kidman, Meryl Streep, and now Julianne Moore is going to be Roxanne Coss. You can see why I'm holding my breath.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So no.
So no.
Okay.
It's a good life.
This one took the least amount of research.
Yes.
Normally you've been like a...
Yes, it did.
Because, you know...
I just like flipped through the photo albums of the family. It's, you know, it's so strange because it really is in so many ways about my family, but exactly the same amount that Bel Canto or any of the other books seem to be about my family. They're all about my family. So this, I'm not breaking new ground here in a funny way.
And another thing is you say that you're not even sentimental.
I'm not a sentimental person, no, I'm not.
And yet so much of your work has been drawn from your own past, the emotion of your past, the troubles and the triumphs of your years on Earth. And it feels, all right.
Back him up, Peter Duncan.
I want to take that back. I'm gonna Bel Recanto. I'm gonna take that back too. But when I think of research that you've done, I mean, when I listened and watched what is State of Wonder, which I absolutely adored. I thought, man, she must have lived in the Amazon, which would not be inconsistent with your life. How did that all come to you? I mean, let's just talk about snakes to begin with.
Let's talk about snakes.
Let's.
Okay, so State of Wonder is a book about two strong female heroines who are not being victimized or falling in love. That's what I wanted to write a book about. Everything else, yeah, really? They're very hard to find. And so, okay, what are these two women? They're doctors. What was their relationship? They were teacher and student. One of them is missing. Everybody thinks that this book is structured on Conrad's Heart of Darkness, but actually it is structured on Henry James, The Ambassadors. And if you have read both Heart of Darkness and The Ambassadors, you will know that it is the same structure, which is character A goes missing, character B is sent to find character A, character B finds character A and finds out character A is happier where he is. So that's both of those books plus State of Wonder. I then came up with a false drug, you know, what would be so profitable. I know so much about mosquitoes and malaria, I could keep you here all night. That was the real research that I did, was about malaria, which I'm fascinated. Anyway, that's a whole other thing.
But you went up the river too.
So yeah, so now what I do for research is I find that if I do my research up front, I get lost in the research. Mm. And I just do research forever because research is fun and writing's not. So what I do is I do my research either at the end or halfway through. And I write it wrong and then I use research to correct. I, for years, wrote for Gourmet magazine. It was the best job I ever had in my life. And I had a fantastic editor named Bill Sertl. And Bill would let me do anything in the world and pay for it. So I called Bill and I said, I need to go to the Amazon. I need a boat in the Amazon. He was like, great, I'll get you a boat. Sends me down to the Amazon.
For gourmet.
Like, you know, it says Gourmet, a magazine of fine living. Bill would always say, you're the fine living part. You're not the gourmet part.
Come to the Amazon, the cooking is delicious.
And I'm a vegetarian, which is insane. It just means that I would lean over and say, how's that pork tasting? That really looks delicious. Could you describe that for me while I eat my plantain? So one day, my husband and I are in an open boat with a guide, and there are probably 10 of us on this boat, which is probably a 15-foot boat, and we are going to go to a nature preserve that has flush toilets. That is how the day is built. We're going to get in an open boat and go 4 hours down a river to a nature preserve with flush toilets. Not that those toilets actually flush anymore, FYI. To make a very long story short, one of the people in this open boat, a guest, not a guide, stops the boat, sticks his hand into the water, and pulls a 15-foot anaconda into the boat. And the first time, he gets the snake here, and the snake comes for his face, and he drops it. So, of course, what do when you drop a 15-foot anaconda into the Amazon? You stick your hand back in and fish around till you find it again. And he did, and he got it way up here at the top of its neck, but I guess the snake is all neck when I think about it. The snake then proceeds to wrap around his body and tries very hard to eat his face, and this guy gives us a lecture on the jaw structure of the anaconda and that it has 3 rows of teeth and recurved teeth, which are not fangs because the anaconda is not poisonous. And he's going on and on.
He's telling you as he's being wrapped up.
Like we're on the Nature Channel. And, you know, we're all kind of in the back of the boat. Interesting fact. An angry anaconda smells like nothing you have ever encountered in your life. And this goes on for about 20 minutes, and then we unwrap him, Greg Greer, who it turns out was a professional snake handler, and we throw the snake back in the water. I write the piece gets shot, and I get paid for it, and we're waiting for it to run in Gourmet. Time goes, it never runs in Gourmet. I call Bill Sertl, I say, Bill, what happened to that piece on the Amazon? It was really good, and the snake part was in the article. He said, didn't I tell you about that? I said, no. He said, we killed it. I said, why? It was good. He said, oh, well, the next time that boat went out, it was taken over by pirates. And they put all the passengers on shore at Machete Point. It was an inside job. And they left them there on the banks of the Amazon, set the boat on fire, and then got into the getaway boat. And he said, we can't actually promote this as a tourist thing anymore, which means that the snake story came back to me because it wasn't in Gourmet, and I put it in the book. Is that what you were expecting?
Imagine if you'd been on the next trip, what your book would have been like.
And it would have been Bel Canto on the Amazon.
I was gonna say.
I gotta tell you, I can think of some horrifying things. I could not write a book about how, I can barely even say, the idea of being put out on the shore of the Amazon in the middle of the night and seeing your boat set on fire. That is above my pay grade. I can think of nothing worse.
I gotta say, it's kind of my style.
that's
exactly the trip I like to take. But you don't write your books in this rapid succession. You don't plan for a lot of them over a period of time. You take time where you simply don't write. You
yeah.
kind of hear the writers say, oh, I write every day. It's
who are those
thing.
People? And they don't. Those people who write every day, they never publish as many books as I do.
Let's put that to the test, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I meet those people all the time. I write every day. I write from 8 until 2, and I write 2,000 words a day. I'm like, where are your books, buddy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've just been working on my obituary. It's
right.
It's taking forever.
But
how do you know when it's time? Like, all right,
everything
I need
that,
to start the book.
Everything that rises must converge. And you begin to write at the moment when the idea of writing becomes less painful than the idea of not writing. Like, it's so horrible to think, I don't want to write, I don't want to write, and then at some point you think, I'm so sick of myself not writing, I begin to write, and then you go down the other side.
That must be a terrible moment in your house.
It's not the best.
You're sitting there with Sparky, everything is going fine, and suddenly you tip.
Yeah, no, it's true.
The whole house slides sideways, your computer comes closer, paper in the printer, and you have to start.
And I always say it's like breaking into Fort Knox with an emery board. I have this whole book in my mind, how do I get in, how do I get in, how do I get in? And then finally I get in. But you know what, I don't want to be that person, especially now that I own a bookstore. I don't ever want to be that person where somebody walks into a bookstore and says, oh my God, how is it possible she has another book out? The way it is now, I feel like people are excited when I publish a book. It seems just right. But I don't want it to be like, oh, I bought that one. It's not even in paperback yet. There's another one? Are you kidding me? Because I feel that way about a lot of, anyway.
And you more than most, because you own a bookstore, you see everything
I
that
see
comes
everything.
Through.
Yeah, I do. I do, and it's not pretty. There's just a lot of... Publishing is a lot of let's throw it at the wall and see what sticks.
I've never seen a book stick to a wall. That would be a terrible cover.
Come to Parnassus, we'll show you.
What is this cover made of? you have an interesting choice of names. Naming is always one of those things that authors talk about. Like some people walk through cemeteries looking for the right names. But you've got Fix Keating. He's
well,
the one
that's
guy
a Catholic
who can fix
thing.
His marriage.
That's a Catholic thing. Francis Xavier.
Fix.
I used to have my hair cut when I lived in Boston at a place that was called Salon Fix because the guy's name was Francis Xavier.
Huh.
That's about
See
as autobiographical as it gets. Seriously. I had my hair cut in Boston.
Well, even, you know, this book about family, you give the one of the lead men, his last name is Cousins.
Right. You know, it's really interesting, especially when you have 11 main characters. And I am very fortunate in that I have very, very close writer friends who edit for me, and I edit for them, and we swap books. But the second person to read this book was my friend Donna Tartt, and she gave me a... like something that seems so obvious now, but I completely missed it. I had 11 main characters, and I think four of them had names that began with an A, which you can't do.
Right.
It really, so when I was finished, I had to go back and rename the characters and fix the, it was the Conroys and the cousins, Fix Conroy, Francis Xavier Conroy, and Elizabeth McCracken said, Francis Xavier Conroy would be Frank Conroy, and Frank Conroy ran the Iowa Writers' Workshop. So people are going to be thinking that you are referencing, and I was like, I would never have thought of that. But it was great. I think of my friends as saving me from future embarrassments. That's what friends are for.
My friends can't do that for me. I just throw myself into it, half-dressed. You write so much about consequence. Everything seems to echo from a mistake of some kind or a choice. And in this book, so many people are defined by the choice of their parents, as many lives are. You know, your possibilities change immediately. And Fanny realizes that kind of near the end that, oh, you know, how much of my destiny has been curbed by the decisions of my parents. Do you ever think about, obviously you think about that when you write, but have you thought about that throughout your life? Like, who would I be if I hadn't gone through all these things which were so, you know, so much disarray early on?
Do you need it? And I have to say, I am, I'm totally fine with it. I'm a big believer in, I love my life, I like where I am, and so any decision that was made got me here, and it's fine. I never look back and think, oh, if only I had gone left instead of right. But I'm really glad that you asked me that, because I always pride myself on the fact that I never get stumped. And I was, early on in this tour, I was doing an onstage conversation, and someone said, was there ever a moment in your life, like that kiss at the beginning of the book, in which you could go back and say, from that moment, everything in my life changed. Mm-hmm. And I said, I wish I had your phone number so I could call you at 3 o'clock in the morning when I wake up and think of the answer to this question. But I did. I did, in fact, wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning in some strange hotel room and realize that there was a moment that I could trace everything back in my life to and say, if I hadn't walked through that room at that moment, every single thing in my life would have been different.
Wow.
Do you have any of those?
I try not to think about it.
No, but seriously, can you think about that?
I never had the opportunity to join Van Halen. But I really think that would have been better than what I did with my life.
Might as well jump, right?
Oh. Right. Ladies and gentlemen, Ann Patchett. We talked about this on the phone, but Ron Charles at the Washington Post described your writing as minimalist because of how tightly bound your language is, how carefully you use it, how your narrative is so beautiful in its progression. And I find that people in your books don't have things. And talking to you, I find that you don't have things, really.
I got some things.
Not a lot of things. You're a minimalist, though. And I think that's interesting that someone would describe your work as kind of reflecting something about you in your own life. Did that start early, like because of moving and because of this all these different things in your life? Like taking things was hard to do. So you don't take so many things, you don't keep so many objects.
But my sister keeps everything. My sister is nothing weird about it, nothing like pack radish about it, but I think that for my sister, moving meant hanging on to prom corsages and concert tickets and, you know, the mementos of dates, which it wouldn't even occur to me. I mean, I had the attitude of, this was our life, let's travel fast and light. And my sister, who moved more than I did, said, I want to hang on to everything because things keep falling away. Mm-hmm. So I think that it can go either way. We have a nice house in Nashville where people come. We have more house guests than any people I have ever encountered. We set human records for house guests. And two of my favorite house guests, or I should say three of my favorite house guests, are here in the audience tonight. We will talk about them in a little bit. But people often come to our house when they're falling apart, and they say it's because it's so peaceful and it's so quiet. And I always say, actually, it's just because we don't have a lot of stuff. You know, there's nothing on the tables. It's clean. It's open space. But that's just my aesthetic.
What I find, and I found it very funny, because it's like one of the greatest moves ever, is in Commonwealth, when the estranged, abandoned mother sends the four children to her very obnoxious husband in Virginia to live with them, they show up at the airport with no luggage. Nothing. No change of clothes. It's like the greatest move ever, maybe. And at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, you don't carry a lot of stuff. All this kind of comes to a head in this one place where you show up in a place with no luggage. How did that idea come to you?
Well, certainly my siblings never showed up with no luggage, although they often showed up without some essential thing. But it was really more a matter of what they did show up with, which was they often came across country with their pets. And it was a very specific sort of dig to the father and to my mother. It's like, you've got to deal with my four kids and also the Labrador puppy I bought 2 weeks ago. Go on. So it wasn't a matter of luggage. Again, going back to my mother, none of it happened and all of it's true. But that emotional energy of people showing up in your life, either with not the stuff they're supposed to have or the stuff they're not supposed to have, the kittens, Red and Buttercup, who showed up one summer, or Licorice the Labrador, and the idea was the animals all had a one-way ticket.
So. Should buy them a moose the day before they got on a flight.
Yeah, exactly. Here, take it back. But that weird communication that happens when people fly across country and they don't know what's coming. Do you want to hear the story of how I met my step-siblings?
Yes.
It's a really good story.
I do.
So I was probably seven when my mother and stepfather got married. We moved to Tennessee from California because my mother had divorced my father and had taken up with a guy who was a doctor who was starting his medical practice, and we trailed along after him. And they got married probably a year after we got to town. And we lived in a little town outside of Nashville called Murfreesboro, and it was in a rough neighborhood, and we didn't have any money. And one day I came home, and I was probably eight at this point, seven, something like that, and there was a boy in the kitchen making a sandwich. And I said, "Get out of my kitchen." And he looked at me and he said, "Get out of my kitchen." And that's how my stepbrother and I met. Because we were never told that there were four other kids coming, and the four kids who had flown in that day were not told that their dad had remarried and there were two more kids. Because we existed, now don't, before you feel all sad for us, there was an age before child psychology. There really was. And people didn't worry about their kids. People didn't make play dates for their kids. People didn't sign them up for lessons. You know, kids were sort of like free range animals. And nobody thought, well, I mean, she's seven, but I guess I should tell her that we're getting married. I remember one night my mom coming home from a date and I said, "What did you guys do?" And she said, "We got married." And we were like, "What? He's not staying, is he?" But people didn't talk to their kids back in the 70s.
I think they talked to them more than that.
Really? Well, you were just very lucky. I'm older than you. You, son, there are just things you don't know.
You never told me.
And now look, I'm telling him on stage.
And And let's go into that. You held off marriage for a good long time.
I did.
Was that because you were seeing marriage through that lens in your youth? And
no, I got married when I was 24. I got married for a year when I was 24. And
but not again until...
Till I was 41. But when I was 20, when I got out of that marriage when I was 25, I made a little pact with God, saying, if I can get out of here, I will never get back in again. I will never, never do this again.
How do you break that pact?
So my husband and I dated for 11 years, and I bought a house to just show my commitment. I bought a house down the street from him to show him how much I loved him and that I was in it for the long haul. I always said, let's stay together until one of us dies. All right, I think that really smacks of commitment. And then he got sick and he was gonna die. He got really sick. And they told me he was gonna die. I went up to the Mayo Clinic. He was at the Mayo Clinic. They said, it's not looking good. So I said, okay, we'll get married. Because you can't unplug the respirator as the girlfriend. You have to be the wife.
And you're not sentimental, so.
I'm not joking. I mean, really and truly.
He's done.
We were in the airport in Rochester, Minnesota, coming back, and we were sitting, waiting for the plane. I said, I guess when we get back, we should get married. And he said, yeah, I guess. And that was it. And then we got a marriage license. We called a friend of ours, who is a priest, who runs the homeless shelter. We said, we need you to marry us. He said, I don't marry people. I said, that's great, it's perfect. I just need you to sign this. And he called, and a couple days later, he said, I'm going to a Kentucky Derby party in your neighborhood, and I can swing by and sign it. And the funny thing is, we can never remember when we got married, but one day a year, we open up the paper and we say, it's Derby Day, happy anniversary. He signed the marriage license. I took it over to my mom. She signed the witness thing, and I mailed it in, and I am as married as you are.
Now, he's a doctor.
Yeah.
Do you think this is all an elaborate trick to fake his near death so you would get married?
You know, I was there, and I saw the film, and it looked quite bad. He looked like a goner.
He knew what he was doing.
There was something very weird going on. There was something very, very weird. Once he was better, and then 2 months later, he was totally fine. He was totally fine. And when I married him, I was told that half of the muscle tissue in his heart was dead, and he was on a transplant list, okay? So I said, now, there are three absolute truths. Absolute truth number one, half the muscle tissue in your heart is dead. Is that true? I saw the film. That is true. Yes? Yes, he says. Absolute truth number two, heart muscle tissue does not regenerate. That is medically impossible. True. Yes? Yes. Absolute truth number three, there is now no dead muscle tissue in your heart. Is that correct? Correct. And I said, one of these three things is a lie. I am married and I no longer own my own home. You really need to tell me which of these three things is a lie. And he was like, why worry about it? Everything's fine. We're so happy. It's great. We're married. But somebody actually gave me a good explanation, which is if you happen to coincidentally have this test while you have an active virus in your heart, the tissue can be stunned, and then the virus can pass and your heart can be fine. That's the only thing that I've ever heard that sounded the least bit convincing, and even that didn't sound so convincing.
It's pretty good, though.
It's good, yeah. He loves me.
11 years of courting is a good long time.
Yeah.
At least you know it's going to last.
Yeah, and it's 22 years now, so it's good.
Yeah.
Hey, marriage! Woo!
We would love to hear you read a little bit of your book.
Would you be willing to do that? You know what? Let's not, because it's 10 of 8.
I mean, it is cheating. They can read it, too.
Oh, but, really? Is that a moan? You want to hear me read a page of this book?
You could just read the first sentence. All I love right. that sentence.
Okay, the first sentence is...
You have to read it from the book.
The party took a turn when Albert Cousins arrived with gin. I hope you enjoyed that. There's something so much more important to talk about.
There's several other things to talk about. First of all, you were in Time's 100 most influential people in the world.
In the world.
In 2012.
Are you feeling influenced, Ben?
I am.
Are you feeling, force field of my influence right now?
I feel like if my heart was 3/4 dead, the mere touch or the word yes from you.
That's right.
And I would be fine.
Right back.
But, so, you know, you're on the list with Kim Jong-un.
Yeah. It's true.
I would be so tempted to abuse that relationship. Have you done anything with your power?
A couple of years before that, my friend Liz Gilbert was one of the most influential people in the world. And I was really blown away. I mean, of all the things that had happened to Liz, I was just so impressed. Oh my God, you're one of the most influential people in the world. This is such an honor. And then, like 3 years later, it happened to me, and I called her up and I said, "This is the ridiculous sham, isn't it?" And she said, "Yeah, I didn't want to tell you. It is a ridiculous sham." Yeah.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more of Benjamin Bush's conversation with Ann Patchett.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Benjamin Bush's conversation with Ann Patchett.
You know, I think it'd be great for us to take questions from this Traverse City audience. It feels like about that time.
So now the house lights come back up so we can see who might be asking us a question.
And we have mics.
Hi. And if you raise your hand, I will.
We have someone right here. Our first mic, please, in the front. Hold on 1 second, please.
I'm wondering what your moment was when you that could have changed your life one way or another. The question that he asked you earlier, and you said, yes, there was a moment, but you didn't say what it was. Did you?
It's back when they didn't tell us anything.
It involved a man. So I was at an artist colony, and I had gotten there that day, and it was late at night, and I didn't know anybody, and I was walking through a room, and when I was in the middle of walking through a room, a woman came in, and she was crying, and it was a room full of women. And she said, "I think I'm having a miscarriage. I need to go to the hospital." And there was a man in the room, and he said, "I have a car, I can drive you." And I looked at all these women, and I said, "Well, a woman should go too, in case somebody has to go back with her." And so we went, the three of us went to the hospital. It was about 11 o'clock at night. And she came out at 6 o'clock in the morning, and she was fine. She had not lost the baby. She had the baby. Everything turned out to be fine. But somewhere between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m., everything changed. And later it changed back. But it was one of those nights. Yeah. Next question.
Listen, right, can we get the mic? It's actually right there to.
I was at the world premiere of Bel Canto.
Oh, good.
In the Lyric Opera. And I just wondered,
what your reaction to the staging and the production was.
I loved it. I loved everything about it, every minute of it. I just thought it was a joy. I had nothing at all to do with it. And I was so proud of them, Jimmy Lopez and Nilo Cruz and Renee Fleming, who commissioned it. I thought everybody did a terrific job. Not because I had any association. People kept saying, this must be the most exciting thing that ever happened to you. And I was like, I haven't read this book since 2000. I don't know anything about this book. But I was really, really happy for my friends. They just did a great job, and it was a success. And it's going to be on PBS. They taped it. So apparently in January or February, it's all ready to go. Watch your local listings.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much for coming to Traverse City.
I'm happy to be here.
Many people who are very happy to have you here. You're one of my top 10, and
thank
my
you.
Youngest daughter, who teaches at Ole Miss, favorite author. But I heard a story about you, and I want you to tell me whether it's true or not,
okay.
Because I've repeated it.
Lay it on me.
Now,
let's clear it up now before you repeat it again.
Yes. My oldest daughter, who works for American Library Association, said she talked to you once at one of the ALA conferences, right after you opened your bookstore, and you told her that when somebody comes and brings a book, I won't mention a title or anything like that, because she didn't to me, and that's a polite thing to do, but when somebody brings a book to you that's not very salesy, literary, that you have a pile of books to the side and said, yes, I'm happy to sell this to you, but I'd like you to read this book too, and they always do. Is that true?
Yeah, it's a version of that. The story that I tell, and is really my favorite story, is there was a young woman in the bookstore not soon after we opened who was walking around with a copy of The Beautiful and the Damned. I don't even know why we were selling The Beautiful and the Damned, but I said to her, wow, you must be some sort of huge Fitzgerald fan to be reading The Beautiful and the Damned. And she said, I've never read any Fitzgerald. This is my first book. I said, you've never read Gatsby? And she said, no, Tender as the Night? No, I'm starting here. I said, why in the world are you starting with The Beautiful and the Damned? She said, because my roommate told me that it was Fitzgerald's best novel. I said, your roommate's an idiot. Nobody reads The Beautiful and the Damned unless they're doing their dissertation on Fitzgerald. Read Gatsby. You know, let's work up in the right order, because if you start with The Beautiful and the Damned, you're never going to read anything else. It's not that I take books away from people that are not commercial, but when I see someone, especially if it's someone that I've been talking to, who is holding a book that I have read that I know to be a bad book, I will say, I think we can do better than this. Because it's part of trust with a bookseller, you know. And I know that there are some things that are a matter of taste. Oh, I remember we had been open for about a week, and a really good friend of mine, smart, terrific reader, who worked at the store, was hand-selling a copy of The Elegance of the Hedgehog. And I actually said, are you kidding me? And I thought, oh, I've got to keep my mouth shut. I can't do this. You guys, what? You all love The Elegance of the Hedgehog? The end? No. That bus? No. So anyway, I try to work with people. I try to work with people and make sure that they get the good books that will keep them reading and coming back.
I think it's the best part of coming into an independent bookstore is that you have people who read books and then they can recommend books to you. They hand sell good books.
It's matchmaking.
Great.
It's a wonderful thing to be able to set somebody up with a book. Can I just give you my 2-minute lecture about this, guys? Because this is what I do and because I own a bookstore. I like to say I care not how you read, but that you read. And there are, if you like to read on a screen, as my husband does, reads 20 times more books than he ever read when he read paper books, there are books like Dogs as I See Them. So if you want... So if you want to support your local independent bookstore, but you like to read on a screen, there are a lot of books like Dogs as I See Them, children's books, cookbooks that you can buy. I would also like to say that I don't care at all if you use Amazon, which people don't actually believe. If you want to stay home and order your books online for a lower price, A-OK by me. But what you can't do, cannot ever, ever, ever do, is then go into Horizon or any of your local brilliant bookstores here in Traverse City and talk to the smart staff and hang out and take your children and your grandchildren to story time or come to an author event or soak up any of the resources that those stores have to offer and then go home and order your book on Amazon, because then I will hunt you down. So make your choice. Also, if there are things in your community you enjoy, like firefighters, police officers, teachers, libraries, schools, you might want to support local businesses that create your local tax base. Because Amazon has a warehouse in the great state of Tennessee where they pay not one dime in tax. All right, end of lecture. Next question.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to go back to the snakes for a second. The State of Wonder was my favorite of your books. And so in the context of that and the tribal society that is visited, I wanted to ask for your thoughts on cultural appropriation.
Sure thing. Oh, that's it. You're just asking my thoughts on cultural appropriation.
What are your thoughts on, is it real? Is it a problem? Why not?
Here's the thing. The stakes get higher when you do cultural appropriation. I cannot live my life writing novels about 52-year-old white Catholic women. I would die of boredom. So I do firmly believe that the imagination is limitless, and no one is ever able or allowed to tell me what I am and am not allowed to imagine. My imagination can go anywhere it wants to go. I believe it is an empathetic act to imagine the lives of other people and try to put yourself in their skin as a reader or as a writer. But the thing is, if I do a bad job, you are allowed to rake me over the coals and criticize me all you want and tell me that I had no business doing this. That is your right. So it is my right to do it. It is your right, not you specifically. It is one's right to hate me and criticize me for doing it. I just think that's the deal. We have a question up here.
Who are your favorite authors and what are you reading now?
Oh, I love that. My favorite authors, living or dead? Do you have a preference? I'm reading a book right now that a bookseller gave me a couple of nights ago in Milwaukee called All My Puny Sorrows. And the author's last name is Miriam Towes, T-O-W-E-S, and it's been out a couple of years, and she's Canadian. And I'm liking it. I have Zadie Smith's Swing Time in my suitcase. That'll be out in a couple of weeks. I just finished a book by Beverly Lowry called Who Killed These Girls, which is a true crime book about the yogurt shop murders in Austin, Texas. The things that I read now that I have a bookstore, you can't even believe. And that is, if you are into true crime, it is a brilliant book. I used to just read Henry James over and over again. I have read The Awkward Age 3 times. I think that would just be me. I love Miley Malloy. I love Donna Tartt, Jane Hamilton, Louise Erdrich, Elizabeth Stroud. There's been a lot of great, great nonfiction this year. Susan Faludi's In the Dark Room, which no one seems to be reading night after night. I'm like, show of hands. Okay, show of hands. What is it? What is it with that book? It is so good, so amazingly good. Hope Jaron's Lab Girl, Paul Kalanithi's When Breath Becomes Air. Terrific. I mean, 2016 has been a knockout year, and two of my very favorite books are the two underground books, Ben Winter's Underground Airlines, Colson Whitehead's Underground Railroad. Fabulous, both of them, and wonderful to read them as a pair. Jacqueline Woodson's Another Brooklyn. I have a blog. I hate that word, cannot bear it. I write once a month a report for the Parnassus Bookstore about everything that I'm reading. And if, God forbid, you go to annpatchett.com or parnassusbooks.net, you can find it. So all the books that I am talking about, you will find on that website. And you will not buy them from my store. You will buy them from your store, okay? Mm. Thank you. Do you want to just shout it out and I'll repeat it?
Did you have to wait for anyone in your family to die before you wrote?
Yes. Yes, did I have to wait for anyone in my family to die before I wrote Commonwealth? Yes, I had to wait for my father to die. And I was writing the book while he was dying, and I knew that he was never going to see it. My father was very involved in my work. He loved nothing more than to mark up my manuscripts, but my father was the morality police, and he would freak out if anybody was smoking a cigarette. I always say the reason my books are so often taught in colleges and high schools is that no one has sex and no one swears and no one ever has a cigarette after sex in which they were swearing. So the fact that my father was dying, I just thought I would like to reclaim my whole brain. I would like to write a character who was a police officer who isn't my father, but he's a police officer because I know a lot about cops. And it was great to be able to do that. Thank you.
Anne, we want to welcome you to Traverse City from Michigan Writers. I'm in the back here.
Okay, hi.
And I two questions real quick. If you could say a little something about your mother as a writer.
Yeah.
And also, I don't know if you know that David Sedaris says that you have written the smartest stuff on being a writer. Maybe you could share a little bit of that with the audience.
Okay, my mom is Jean Ray, and when she was 60, she wrote her first book, which was called Julie and Romeo. She wrote five books, and I like to say my mother is the spokesperson for sex over 60. My mother writes very funny, very comic, short, smart novels about older people working out the problems in their life and falling in love and having a good time. And my mom is great. She lives down the street from me. She's terrific. David Sedaris, may God bless and keep him. He has been such a friend to me. And in the same way I take Dogs as I See Them out on book tour, when David was out on his last book tour, he took the paperback of This is the Story of a Happy Marriage and he sold it every night. And somebody just said that they saw him in an event where he was selling Commonwealth. So, love him. Love him. David Sedaris and I don't necessarily have an obvious overlap audience. So when he tells 4,000 people in the Hollywood Bowl to read my book, it has a big impact. And he's a terrific guy. We've had him in the bookstore. He's the most generous, the dirtiest. Woo! I mean, the jokes that he makes when you're in the room, it's astonishing. If you ever have a chance to catch his show, he is just terrific, but really generous and kind to everybody. He'll sign books until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, we had him here for the National Writers Series early on, and he did exactly that.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Incredible. Hey, Balcony.
And thank you for coming to Traverse City. You are delightful. My question is, what is the best thing about being on book tour? What is the worst thing about being on book tour?
It's your last night.
Okay. Yeah, this is the last night of book tour. The best thing about, I know I'm supposed to say, it's this, it's you, it's us. Okay, and this is fine. The best thing is meeting booksellers. The best thing is going into bookstores, which has always been the best thing, but now more than ever, And I am this year the ambassador for BINC, which is the Book Industry Charitable Foundation, which gives emergency grants to booksellers in need. And so I am going all over the country talking to booksellers about BINC and the fact that if they get sick and they can't pay their deductible, or they don't have health insurance, as many booksellers don't have health insurance, or there's a natural disaster or whatever. I met a bookseller whose mom had just died unexpectedly, and BINC paid for the funeral expenses. They have educational grants. So that's incredible. I love going into bookstores and saying, oh, I see that in your back room you have this categorized in this way and we do it this way. And I'm obsessed with side items. I found these little stuffed hedgehogs at Powell's in Portland. It's going to change the face of publishing, these little stuffed hedgehogs. I said to the guy at the cash register, I picked one up and I was like, how you doing with the hedgehogs? And he said, we could stop selling books tomorrow. It's like, it is all about the hog. Those are really my joyful moments. The airports are hard and the hotels are hard. And going to bed without dinner night after night is sort of just depressing. It's really physical wear and tear. It's a city a night. And I never have any idea where I am. I was saying to Ben before we came on, the only thing I ever remember is backstage. Like, I can, if you put me back in that backstage area 20 years from now, I would be like, Traverse City, yeah, I remember this cable. I remember the back of these curtains. And that's sort of all I remember. And on one hand, I feel like what I'm doing is really important. I know it's important because this is how bookstores make their money, is when somebody comes into town and draws a big audience and people buy a lot of books. And I'm really, really invested in independent bookstores making money and making their payroll and being able to take care of their employees. Nothing means more to me than that. Nothing I have ever done in my life means more to me than the fact that I have created jobs in my community. I cannot believe that that is the case, but I am so passionate about that. I'm passionate about bringing readers together, and people are always saying, oh, books are dead, people don't care anymore, then what the hell are you doing here, really? People are so involved in reading, and they get in the line, and they talk to each other, and they share ideas about books. I love being part of that. But you know, at some point, I just think, can I physically keep doing this? There's like, you get up in the morning and there'll be blood coming out of my ear. It's just, it's so hard and nobody wants to hear it. But again, this is the last night, so you asked. There you go.
So I wanted to come back to your 100 most influential people in the world.
Right.
And I wondered, I was curious if it comes with a personal responsibility.
No.
That's one. And I wondered if you feel you're having, I mean, you just sort of answered this part of it, but maybe there's a subset to this. If you feel you're having an influence, what is that? And what kind of influence would you like to have at this time in our world?
I do have an influence, not only for bookstores, but I think for the whole shop local, you know, support, just have awareness. Americans seem to be completely helpless in the face of lower prices. And the idea that if something is $3 cheaper, that's really all that matters. It's not my fault. There was nothing I could do about it. I love the fact that I can go around and talk about it in a way that people listen and they laugh. And if another bookseller stood up and said, don't shop on Amazon, support your local independent bookstore, it doesn't come across in the same way. I'm really able to do this, and that works very well. I find in the last 5 years since I've had the bookstore that I can use this power that I have for a lot of good. And I can do the fundraiser for the homeless shelter. I can do fundraisers for the library systems, and I can really get people to be aware of what's going on in their communities. That is a terrific power. Now I'm going to tell you a really good story about going to the Time 100 party, because there's this fantastic party at the Time Warner Center. And past winners can come back, although you can't ever bring anybody with you. You can only bring somebody the year that you win. And you get to meet all of these amazing people in a pretty small room. But when I won, Rihanna won. And so she was the entertainment. And so Rihanna is doing her show, and she's on stage, and she says, okay, Time 100, everybody clap your hands. You all know the words, let's all sing. And Stephen Colbert and Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright and me, and everybody's got their phone, no, I don't have a phone, but everybody's like, madly Googling Rihanna song lyrics. Rihanna was the only person in the room singing, and she was like, hey everybody, come on. Don't be shy, y'all sing out. And the girl from Afghanistan who drove a car without a headscarf, and she's one of the 100, she's like, who's Rihanna? What is she singing? That's my very happiest memory of the Time 100. And I said to my husband, I was like, oh my God, she's so pretty. And Carl said, she's 23, that's her job.
I have a question for Ben.
Good, thank God.
Ben, I loved Dust to Dust. What are you working on now?
Oh, thank you so much. Whatever doesn't pay. I just finished illustrating a book for an anthology of veteran fiction writing called The Road Ahead, which comes out in January. So I got to go back to my hand drawing with charcoal and pencil, which is a lot of fun. I was just in Florida wearing about 30 pounds of leather and metal in a warehouse lit by torches with no AC to play a gladiator, which was not a porn. So for about 10 hours a day, I was beating on somebody in a movie, which is to be seen, maybe, at some point. And I write a lot of poetry, narrative poetry, which, as you know, is probably going to get me on the Time 100, so I can use my power of influence in verse. I have a lot of things going on. I would love to tell you something is actually going to arrive in your in your mail soon, but stay tuned.
Traverse City, I have really enjoyed spending my last night of book tour with you. Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
That was Ann Patchett talking with Benjamin Bush. Ann Patchett's latest book is Commonwealth. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.